now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking about Gareth Southgate's genius master plan to lower expectations for Euro 2024 as England lose 1-0 to Brazil at Wembley. And we'll also look ahead to their clash with Belgium, when he might just get a little 0-0 draw again to keep those expectations nice and low. We'll also reflect on who could possibly replace Southgate when that day arrives, Wales' efforts to reach Euro 2024, and stupid footballers and the rise of the Academy star. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have senior sports writer and columnist Matt Dickinson, a former footballer who faced Belgium twice for Ireland in a World Cup playoff for France 1998. Won't mention the fact that they didn't make it. It's Tony Cascarino, and another former footballer who didn't face Belgium at all in his 15 appearances for Scotland's under-21s, but did secure massive wins against Norway and Austria. Gregor Robertson is here too. That was nicer than the Belarus one, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, he picked another team I scored against.
Tom. Yeah, exactly. I've just given you the little chance to get in there. Anyway, moving on from Norway and Austria and to Wembley and the mighty Brazil, who England faced on Saturday night. Now, I don't really know what to make of this game, because obviously I was joking about Gareth Southgate lowering expectations, but at the same time, he did make me look rather stupid, because every day I have to go on Times Radio at lunchtime to join Matt Chorley's lunchtime show and talk about sport. And on Friday, I went on and say, England are favourites for this, Matt. They're going to show the mighty Brazil what's what, how to play football. Thanks, Gareth. Cheers, lads. It wasn't great, was it, Dicker?
I think the first paper aeroplane was 3 minutes, wasn't it? But I'm actually not blaming England. It was a weirdly silent, quiet crowd. I mean, I know the game didn't fizz particularly in the first 45 minutes, apart from the odd Rodrigo flick or touch or Vinicius run, but really? I just thought we could do better than that.
Thought there should be more excitement?
I always found it odd that, it's England-Brazil. It was an almost full crowd at Wembley. It's an England team that, did not sparkle as we might hope. But, blaming the fans isn't a road down for popularity. But I just sat there just looking around going, what's up with everyone?
You're going full Delia Smith. I love it. You don't have to get you on the pod, but it's great to have you in here. Do. Tony, what do you reckon?
No St. George's cross on the shirt.
Oh.
Do you think that was it? Was everyone? Silent protest.
I'll tell you what it was, because I knew quite a few people that went to the game, and a lot of them took their sons or their daughters and went there as the family, to go and watch England. What a lovely occasion. And I felt it didn't have the sort of hardcore feel about the game. It felt like, this is a lovely friendly, that you play in sometimes, and it's against the great opposition, the mighty Brazil, and not much more than that. I was more bothered by what I saw on the pitch. But then, what do you make of games leading up to tournaments?
What did you see on the pitch?
Well, I came away, and I'm getting really bothered, because it's an old chestnut that I talk about, but I keep thinking in my head, is anyone even going to be, can even consider that the guy that's second in the top of the goal scoring charts is Ollie Watkins with 16, which has had a phenomenal season, by the way. And then you've got Harry Kane, who's got 31 goals in the Bundesliga and get goals for fun at every level. Couldn't England play, and I look at the way they played the other day, could they not be a 3-5-2? No, 3-5-2. 3-5-2, but play them two. Because I kept thinking of any era, from whether it was Ferdinand and Shearer, Sheringham and Shearer, Beardsley and Lineker, and many, many other partnerships up front. Why on earth couldn't them two play? Just as a long-term plan for England of being successful. Because one thing I learned through tournaments is that certain styles, I sat next to Emi Jacquet in a dressing room before 98 World Cup, and his son was a professional footballer for Nancy, okay? And I sat there and we talked, and he was getting a lot of stick. And he said, I believe in Zidane, the number 10. He said, but with that, we haven't got... And he explained to me that France didn't have two natural centre forwards the way he wanted to play. And he said, I've got to construct my team around Zidane and how we can win. And I kept thinking, that sounds great. Proof is in the pudding. And of course, they won it. And that always struck me that no one can really remember, except for people who are diehard, you know, purists of football, that Guy Vache played number nine for France. But his idea was that he couldn't pick two centre forwards to play for France. He would have done that because of Zidane, but that was the way they'd win the cup, World Cup. Well, 86 was about Maradona being the best number 10 in world football. And that's why Argentina eventually won the tournament, because the best number 10 was their style and they went on and won it. And I keep thinking, would you ignore Mo Salah with Egypt? No, of course you wouldn't. He's an obvious starter.
But you're not surely saying that Watkins is... Who's the must pick? Kane's got to be in the team. Do we really need two strikers if you've got Kane and then you've got Bellingham running up alongside him? You've got Saka cutting in. You've got a Rashford.
You were at the game.
Yeah.
Did you not think England lacked a number of bodies getting in the 18-yard box?
I just thought the combinations weren't working. It felt like a bit of a disjointed team. I mean, Bellingham was pushing very high.
That's
one of the big dilemmas for us, obviously, because if you've got Bellingham as a number 10, then Foden gets pushed to one of the more wide roles, and then I think he gets quite peripheral in an England team that has not got 70% possession like Man City have. So, yeah, I mean, there are undoubtedly sort of bits of the puzzle that don't quite fit yet, right? But I'm just not convinced. I mean, as part of the fit in it is throwing another striker the answer when actually...
If I was at club level and I had two players that scored as many goals as them, because they do, Watkins and Kane, I'd find a way and make the team play around for them to get chances. Because the Brazilians were quite comfortable defensively in the game. They were. And Ollie Watkins is unsure. Kane can drop in. We all know Kane can drop into a space when they don't have the ball. We all know he can do that.
He was protected. I mean, with the issue he's got, he obviously was protecting him from this.
Yeah. Really mean this game. Yeah. I just came away thinking, you know, we all talk about systems and players who should play. But if you find you've got something special, and I do think if you're looking at a forward line that you could go two centre forwards and they are guaranteeing you 50 goals in a season at club level, I do my damnedest to get them into the team. And yes, Bellingham's very important to this as well.
England have just got so many.
Here we go. Here's the reason, Scott.
I love as well international week. We were beforehand, we were going, there wasn't much going on there, was there? And then, like, already, you can see nothing exercises the panel more than England.
Well, you were there as well, Gregor, and you were impressed by Anthony Gordon, to Tony's point.
It kind of goes against Tony's point. I don't think it's about just getting your best players on the pitch. I think it's important to have balance. And I think Gordon sort of highlighted that fact because England, that's one area. Another area. They don't really have a natural fit for the left-sided role. You could say Rashford, but he's not in good enough form. You could say Grealish, but he's not fit, and he's also never been trusted to start. Foden feels like you're accommodating Foden on the left because everyone wants to play Saka on the right, and Bellingham's going to play number 10, so he's not going to play. So you're accommodating Foden, whereas Gordon that's his position. Yeah. And, you know, everyone is an inverted winger these days. It's always a right-sider who can drift inside in combinations and go down the outside. And I think we saw that, you know, he was probably the brightest. Him and Bellingham were the two brightest players for England. And I think you saw the value of having, like, a square peg in a square hole. Hmm. So I get what you're saying. You could easily play two up front, but then, you know, that would open up so many. I think you'd be leaving out more of your talented players.
Well, who would you be leaving out?
Well, you'd be leaving out probably Saka, you'd be leaving out.
You couldn't play him as a wing back when I said 3-5-2.
Crikey. I mean,
why couldn't he play that role? He's played it for Arsenal.
He's stumped.
No, I mean, I think the likelihood of Gareth Southgate playing Saka.
I didn't say 4-4-2.
Almost minuscule.
You didn't go full Mike Bassett.
I didn't go 4-4-2. I went 3-5-2.
I know, but again, I think the likelihood of him playing Saka as a wing back is minuscule. And then, so then again, you're leaving out probably Foden then. Yeah, because Bellingham has to play in behind. England have an embarrassment of riches. What we're seeing, I think, is, like, as I say, it's going to come down to a moment in time. It's going to come down to who arrives in the summer in the best form, you know, we see who you think Southgate naturally wants to play, but there will be many sort of conflicting interests and sort of, you know, forces before the summer to decide who's going to play.
Because Rice, you know, we've all seen that, you know, Rice, part of his blossoming at Arsenal is actually being more front foot than he has been at West Ham. But in this team, unless you say play Emenu behind, you know, how does he get to be on it, on his front foot, unless you bring in another holder? But of course, the idea of bringing in another holder gets the whole country groaning of, you know, oh my God, it's going to be, you know, Calvin Phillips, or, you know, it's sort of Gareth being Gareth. So, but I mean, I'm with you on the balance point. I think that is the, we've seen too many times that an England team has lacked balance. I think Gareth Southgate has actually, you know, it's a sort of counterintuitive. He's been ballsy enough to sort of not tip into an unbalanced team. I think he's probably been a notch more cautious than people have wanted, the fans have wanted. But actually, I think there's been success in that. I think it's given the team confidence that they, you know, to have got as far as they had. Of course, there are times when you think, well, maybe you can be, you know, a bit more daring, a bit more cavalier. But I think Southgate's almost sort of tried to stay true to his instinct, which is England in a tournament, handling the pressure, handling the expectations, handling the history, handling everything that comes with it, are better being, you know, a touch more solid than the populist argument would have it.
Well, the only thing I would contradict on all of this is that, are we going to say that all teams that ever played two up front, because nearly everybody did at one period of time, you know, were unbalanced? You can have a balanced team with two up front.
Yeah, you can. Of course you can.
But can you have Saka, Foden, Bellingham? Yeah. You know, as you say, whether it's a Grealish, a Gordon, or, you know, can you have all of that? Can you then have all of them playing to their strengths?
Just playing devil's advocate to that and kind of siding with Tony is that the problem is that we still talk about all these players and they've never really fully blossomed together. That balance that Gregor talks about with the likes of those players, the Saka, the Foden, that is a big part of the debate, isn't it? Under Southgate, it's always been who are the three or the two who play behind Kane. And maybe there is something bold in saying, "Would you know what? Let's scrap it all together and get the best strikers on the pitch." Because the other point about is you've also got Ivan Toney to factor in, who it looks like he's going to get his chance against Belgium tomorrow night on Tuesday. He's someone who we have talked about on this podcast, and whenever I've posed the question, "Does Ivan Toney get in the England team?" the general response has been yes, but the only way he does is as a two.
Well, Mbeumo at club level plays around him. He's not a natural, I'd say, like, two centre forwards, but he always plays around him because he's quick. He can cover a lot of ground that suits Tony. I'm just, everything is secular, so I always think, when is the partnership going to come back? And it's an old chat that many of us have had many, many times. But I do believe if you're going to get the ball in the box, and like England did at times on Saturday, there was no real threat. Apart from Ollie Watkins in the early part of the game, we had half a chance. And I think if you're going to get the balls into certain areas of the pitch and in the 18-yard box and obviously create chances, you want good finishers on the end of them. Kane is a good finisher. We know that. Ollie Watkins' finishing has improved a hell of a lot. And there are issues because, like any formation, you might gain there, you lose here. Okay? Yeah. That's the job of a manager, to think, well, do I gain more that way or do I lose more? With that choice, that is
one thing to add is that Bellingham is almost playing as a second striker for Real Madrid now, so he can, you know,
yeah,
he can.
Was it you who said the week, if Kane was out, you could even play him as a? Someone said to me the weekend, so you could play Bellingham. So
yeah,
this is like the anti-Tony argument. Yeah. No strikers at all. But, you know, you end up with a front line.
I mean,
of
Brazil kind of did that.
Saka, Bellingham, and Rashford.
Brazil kind of did that. You looked at the team at the start, Rodrigo was the man in the middle, but he was dropping in. It was almost, they had a front four, and they kind of, there was no one that was like a guy who was occupying centre halves. That's kind of, Brazil didn't want to play that way. Look, Kane does that brilliantly, but. Yeah, there's so many options. I always say this every time we have an international break. England's options are ridiculous. It's just about finding the right balance.
No, it's not quite the usual case where I mention, we must mention Brighton, we must mention Fulham, but we should mention Brazil because they were quite good, weren't they? Lots of talk before this game about the Premier League dominance of Brazil's squad, but it was actually players who don't play in England who really stood out, wasn't it, Greg?
No, I mean, I think Paqueta was the best player on the pitch.
Do you? Not Vinicius and Endrick?
No, I think Vinicius was good. He had some great moments, and he's lightning quick, and, you know, he possibly could have scored in the first half. Rodrigo the same, some lovely touches, brilliant poise. He dummied in on Gallagher at the start in the first 10 minutes, and then Gallagher was unfortunate. He was dummied really kind of impressively twice. Paqueta, when he dragged the ball back through and clipped it through, that chance through for Vinicius, was sublime. But Paqueta was the best player on the pitch. He shouldn't have stayed on the pitch. He was committed a ridiculous number of fouls, particularly on Bellingham. But he was outstanding. So many kind of silky touches and just little flourishes that were an absolute joy to watch.
I'd agree with Greg on that. I thought, well, look, David Moyes, pragmatic footballer, a football manager who signed probably one of the most gifted players in world football, because he just sees things really quickly. And his touch, he always finds time. The greatest players that I've ever witnessed always have a split second more than anybody else, and he did it numerous times during the game.
And unexpected things. What about the pass when Bruno lashed out to him? It was almost on the half. A volley almost, it wasn't flush to the grass, and he hit it first time, whipped it just wide of the post. That was no one expected that. He always does the unexpected, which is great to watch. Well, sorry, I completely killed your question.
Don't worry, it's a fan, that's what you're here to do, shoot me down. Back to arguments over England then, and Matt Dickinson, you wrote a column just before Christmas, which is since the last time we've had you on the pod, talking about Gareth Southgate and the plan for after he goes. Who knows when that will be? Performances like this and keep getting killed by Brazil, it might be sooner rather than later. But I wanted to debate that around the likes of Steve Cooper, Eddie Howe, Graham Potter, all people you mentioned in that column. You think England should be planning now, despite having had Southgate for such a long time?
Well, I mean, I think you're not doing your job if you're the FA chief exec, if you don't have your little scrap of paper tucked in your drawer with, here's my wish list. Because, I mean, this contract runs out at the end of the year. They did it to the tournament and then stuck a few months on just to give themselves a bit of sort of wriggle room on that. Now, it might be that Southgate turns around and says he wants to continue, but I think he's rightly said, let's have that conversation after the tournament. I don't think we need to be sort of too flappy about that. And but again, if you're the FA, you should be having discreet conversations. You might lose your manager. You might want to. I personally don't think a guaranteed upgrade is out there from the, shall we say, English.
Do you think it needs to be English?
I don't think it needs to be. I think Gareth Southgate has shown why at a certain time, with his understanding of the job, his Englishness has been a crucial part of his success. He understood what the baggage was. He understood what it is to create an England squad that people want to turn up to. I think, his Englishness mattered. Now, you could say he's restored that bit. Is it so important now? But all I would think is that we should be careful not to lose what he's brought to that, which is, understanding that, creating an ethos was absolutely crucial. The sort of ethos that Fabio Capello, a guy who's, comes with the most glittering CV, didn't understand. He just didn't get it, didn't get that bit of the job. So I think we sort of sacrificed that bit with caution.
In terms of Southgate then and his future, he's been linked with various jobs, and the idea that maybe Manchester United might be sniffing around him as a...
I'd be surprised. I mean, I think he...
Shot down before I even asked the question that time.
No, but I think, if I were him, and as far as I know, he wants to... He feels he has, unfinished business. You could say, barely started business in club management. He wants to go back and show that he's got what it takes. Now, it may be that he loves this. They have a good summer. He thinks... there is still some work to do with England, but I wouldn't be surprised if he thinks, I've done a good old stint and now's the time. I mean, where he comes back in is, I imagine he would hope to be top half Premier League, but...
It'll be fascinating to see. I'm sure it won't be the first and last time we talk about Gareth Southgate's future in the coming months. Now, for this show, we're going to mention quite a lot of listener feedback that we've had over the last couple of months. And we're starting with Martin, who got in touch about Thursday's discussion around best and worst Brazilians in the Premier League. And he said, Tom, I'm getting in touch with not a favourite Brazilian Premier League player, but rather the most disappointing. I offer Cleberson. Forced his way into the World Cup winning 2002 side and provided the engine and heartbeat for that record win. He looked really good. He went to United in the summer of 2003 and some of us were thrilled by this. He turned out to be a dreadful acquisition. He did get injured early on but never looked the part. Peripheral overstates his influence. He limped metaphorically, maybe literally, back to Brazil after a mere 20 appearances. Now, Dicko, you missed this chat. Any favourite and worst Brazilians in Premier League era?
Favourite? I'd say probably just because of the freshers. Juninho at Middlesbrough was probably just because there was a sense of the exotic.
I feel like a moment.
Yeah, it did. I mean, obviously, in the great sort of, list of top Brazilian footballers you've seen, he's not. But I think for just feeling like the Premier League has suddenly got something it lacked, I thought he brought something unique. Worst, blimey, that was Brian's here. The fantasy football used to do that. Pele was shite. feature, and then they'd sort of scoured the archives to get shots of Pele sort of shanking one into the crowd or hitting a duff pass and stuff. It feels like something sacrilegious about sort of concentrating on crap Brazilians. And
it's great. It's great to have Dicko back on the show, isn't it, producer Neil? There you go. Pele was shite. That's a great subject for today's podcast.
Someone should revive that. That was a genius bit of fancy football.
Yeah, Pele was shite is a bold call. We're coming back to England then, and they face Belgium in the next game on Tuesday night. Now, Tony, they were playing against your island this weekend. Drew 0-0, Evan Ferguson missing a penalty. What should England be looking out for? Should they be worried by Belgium? Or is this a chance for Gareth Southgate to get the positivity back?
First of all, Belgium were really poor in the game. Ferguson missed a penalty. Did they offer a threat? No, they were just playing every part of the pitch, just playing football, but keeping the ball and no more. Didn't have a threat.
Does it feel like the end of the kind of Belgian golden era that we've talked about?
Tom. Lukaku was involved. They've had retirements. Courtois weren't in goal. Tielemans was captain. He was probably one of their better players, but they were a really hard watch. They never really tested Ireland at all. I haven't seen the numbers, but they probably dominated possession because they were passing from everywhere, trying to play out from the back. And, okay, to a degree of success in keeping the ball, but no more. I don't know how many changes will come, Tom, because I'm sure there's a good number of players that will come into the game against England. But I was really surprised how poor Belgium were, considering the teams they've had in the past.
Belgium poor or Ireland good? Promise
for Ireland.
I didn't
think Ireland were good. I thought not bad. Got 11 behind the ball when we had to. But then when we got it, we'd give it away quite quickly because everyone's defending. So when the ball goes forward, you give it back to them. And it was sort of that type of game. Ferguson was poor. The boy up front, a lot of hope on him.
Under too much pressure, do you think, maybe?
I just think he looks like a player that's lost a bit of belief. He's gone 4 months without a goal at club level. He's sort of been pushed down the pecking order a bit at Brighton. He's 19, so you expect that this is going to happen. A teenager that, at one time everybody was talking about, he's going to be a £100 million player. He didn't look anything like that, but I saw him on not a very good day, and I've seen him on good days as well. So give him the benefit of the doubt. I just think it's a period of his career where he's slightly gone backwards, a bit of a reality check for him. I'm not quite sure if he's a centre-forward as well.
Really?
Well, it was hard because he was trying to run the channels a lot, and Ireland weren't very good at getting the ball into them channels for him to get there. But he lost a lot of possession on the halfway line where it was fed into him and he couldn't keep hold of it, and then they robbed it off him. He'd done that probably too much in the game. So it was a tough afternoon. Look, I'm very careful. I choose my words with young lads because I've been there and I've had that experience of when it's good, you do really well and everyone bigs you up, and then suddenly you have a stinker. And he just looked like a player that's out of sorts.
Yeah.
He just looked like that to me.
Difficult afternoon for a young player. But some young players who did step up were playing for Wales, led by former Lincoln City legend Brennan Johnson, of course. Come on, Greg. I've got to get it in every now and then again.
Every week.
Yeah, every week. Why not? Beating Finland 4-1 to set up Tuesday's playoff against Poland. This, in kind of contrast to some of those points, Gregor, that we talked about with Belgium and Ireland, did suggest a kind of Wales stepping out of a previous era, the Gareth Bale era, didn't it?
Yeah, and Aaron Ramsey. That's kind of like, it seems every now and then you see this Wales team, it's like a group of young players who are growing together now as well, with a lot of promise. Harry Wilson was brilliant in this game. He's been brilliant this season, in fact, for Fulham. He has.
They're not that young as well, Gregor, are they?
No, well, they're mid-20s now. Yeah. And, but as I say, they've been in part of this group, this Wales squad for a long time, and now they're the main guys, but as I say, they've kind of grown with the players that are playing around them. Nico Williams, great free kick. As I say, Harry Wilson was outstanding. Great to see David Brooks as well get back in the score sheet. Mm-hmm. And it was a nice little move as well, kind of link-up play with Wilson beforehand. And as you say, Brennan Johnson is the man who everyone's sort of hoping is going to step into those shoes. But I think that's the kind of, you know, it's not the right conversation. It's no one's going to step into Gareth Bale's shoes. No one's going to, you know, stand out as like a talisman like that. What they need to be is a team now. And as I say, this is kind of, this was really promising because a lot of young guys, Ampadu as well, he's kind of grown in stature a bit. He's playing every week, albeit in the Championship with Leeds. And Jordan James as well, another really young player. So I think there's a lot to be hopeful for. It's obviously a huge game now against Poland.
Yeah, best of luck to Wales against Poland. Now, finishing off, given that you mugged me off with that Lucas Pekatar answer, Scotland 0, Holland 4. What happened, Gregor?
It wasn't a 4-0, Tom.
Oh, here we go.
It wasn't.
Should have been 8.
Listen, we'll hand it over to Ronald Koeman here. During the first hour, the Scottish team were the better team. They created more chances to score. It was a little bit unbelievable that they didn't because they had so many chances. We knew that before that Scotland would fight. They're a really aggressive team with good players like John McGinn. Now, Ronald knows his stuff.
I'm only sad that when you said we hand over to Ronald Koeman that you didn't do that in a Dutch accent.
Okay. Look, for the first 70 minutes, Scotland were really good. And we missed so many chances.
But when it comes to, you know, big tournaments, this is what happens.
Lauren Shanklin got a chance to, you know, up front he started, and he had a glorious chance as well that he, I think, he hit the bar with. Christie had another that was saved brilliantly by Brentford keeper
Flecken.
Yeah, Flecken was probably the man of the match. I'm not just saying that he was. He made some great saves, and Scotland created chances, which has not always been an easy thing for us to do, but again, there's no one to finish them. So
if only Lyndon was there, right?
Yeah.
Well, you talk ill of Lyndon as a QPR fan, Matt, but
have some good reason.
Lyndon has been an absolute, god for Scotland in some games. So, look, it's the same old story. I think we've got a lot of good players. We've got a great midfield. We've got, we can create chances, but we really are struggling for someone to put the ball in the back of the net.
There you go, England.
But it wasn't a 4-0.
English journalist spoilt rotten with too much talent, and a former Ireland player sticking the boot into his team and a deluded Scot. We've got the full lot on the game podcast. As I said, we're going to have some listener responses and questions in the second half of the show, and if you've got any for us, you can get in touch. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us, we're talking academies and stupid footballers next.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Matt Dickinson, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson. Now, the first half of the show was talking a lot about young players and varying levels of talent. And Gregor Robertson, that leads us nicely onto an excellent long read feature that you did last week that was headlined Elite Academies Creating the Golden Age of Premier League Footballers. With players such as Kobbie Mainoo, Jack Hinshelwood and Jadon Dans flourishing, the biggest battleground among Premier League clubs is now at academy level. And there's a wonderful intro to this that tells us all about the level of detail that clubs go into. Tell us more.
Yeah, Brighton kindly invited me down to spend a day with their academy. And probably the most, you know, there's this kind of, it's almost a cliche when clubs talk about a pathway, you know, the pathway from academy to first team. Brighton kind of showed me how that is in reality. And what their entire kind of senior staff, so the owner, Tony Bloom, David Weir, who I think is technical director, the under-21s manager, the academy director, all the senior staff, they meet like 3 or 4 times a year. And the kind of question they're all asking is, who's next? Who's the next player off the production line? And to answer that, they have something called a depth chart. And I think, you know, I think they're fairly common even in recruitment, but generally speaking, this is about senior recruitment. Brighton's goes down to age 15. So if you're looking for a left back, you say we've got him, but we've got this 15-year-old who we think is coming through. And that influences their decisions, even in first team recruitment.
As in the transfer market. So if they look at it and go, we've got this 15-year-old coming through, maybe we don't need to go into the transfer market.
Yes. So it's like totally holistic. And that kind of underlined the thing that I think is becoming more and more common. I think we've seen it with Liverpool recently too, is that, you know, with Jarrell Kwanzaa, for example, everyone said, Liverpool need another centre-half. Joel Matip's kind of, I think his contract's up in the summer. Konate's injury-prone. We need someone else to go to play alongside Virgil van Dijk, potentially. And they didn't buy anyone because they had Jarrell Kwanzaa. And Jarrell Kwanzaa spent last season on loan at Bristol Rovers. So I think the smartest clubs, certainly, but more clubs, even in the Premier League, and this is also becoming more and more important with the sort of financial fair play regulations and, you know, clubs' inability suddenly to spend as much money, they are looking much more holistically at everyone in their club. It's not like the academy is separate over there. They're completely, side by side. And if they think there's someone good enough, then they're more and more, it feels like they're more willing to trust them. And that's also in that trip, they outlined their belief that players are developing faster. So, you know, we're seeing 17 and 18-year-olds kind of come through, even in Premier League, and getting an opportunity. Lewis Miley at Newcastle is another example. And yes, some of it is like by default almost, you know, there's an injury crisis, whatever. But he's still there and he's good enough at 17 to step into the first team. And they believe that that is a lot to do with, again, the sort of holistic way that players are developed now, and i.e., they're in academies for very young. They're sort of, say Liverpool, for example, the youth teams are coached to play in the way that mirrors Liverpool's. Brighton were telling me examples of like 13-year-olds, like goalkeepers and centre halves, sort of standing on the ball trying to beat the press. Like, they have to discourage that. They have to say, look, we need to try and kind of teach you the full spectrum of how you can play football. But there's more understanding about these sort of tactical developments and stuff. And also, they're developing well-rounded young men. They're developing players who, the day I was there, there were 13 and 14-year-olds on day release from school. And they trained in the morning, and I saw them in the education suite in the afternoon with, you know, tutors, the people to teacher ratios, 3 or 4 to 1. And their attainment levels above national average in sort of GCSEs and stuff. As we see, I referenced Jaden Dan's interview, you see them when they're speaking afterwards too, and you think, my God, you know, this kid who's 18 has just stepped off the bench, scored 2 goals against Southampton in front of the Kop. He's standing in the middle of the pitch with a microphone thrust in his face, and he spoke with great kind of poise, thanked his mum and dad, thanked the coaches, but he was also quite humble. He was asked, you know, are you ready for more of this? He says, no, look, I'm really happy to get my chance and I hope more come. But they're really impressive young guys that are being developed too. So this, you know, this links to a piece that Matt wrote about, the EPPP and Greg Dyke's sort of belief that, well, Matt, you're probably better describing it than me.
It was much fueled by your excellent piece, but it was more, I mean, I was just alerted by someone, someone at the FA she was just chatting to and just said sort of blimey, it was approaching 10 years since the commission came back that Greg Dyke set up, which so in 2013 he had done this sort of landmark speech, I guess, of his leadership, which was, you know, England football, you know, if we carry on the way we're going, we're doomed, to use the phrase about the tanker needs turning. It was a crisis of player development. It was a crisis of lack of choice for England managers.
Do you remember what the context was for that? Was it post Euro 2012? Or
yeah, it was. I mean, it was just the fact that the England team was lurching from one, you know, underperformance to another. It was the fact that we were sort of increasingly headlining the fact that it was approaching 30% and potentially less of English players in first, you know, getting minutes in the Premier League. Was this an issue of quantity as much as quality? You know, then look, obviously we go to Brazil for 2014 World Cup and stink the place out. We go to Euro 2016 at Iceland. So it was as if there was facts. But what wasn't, I guess, you know, if you take a snapshot of the time, you can understand his sort of pressing all the alarm bells. But what probably wasn't factored into his speech was the fact that the academy system was at that time being overhauled in the way that, and has led to, you know, not all over the place, but some of it, certainly pockets of excellent practice, like Greg has just described at somewhere like Brighton. There was also obviously the stuff going on at St George's Park to actually turn it into a place of elite sport, you know, to actually have a break, you know, to have smart people doing smart work. You
that's
know,
blooming in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, I think that the big, I mean, because there's a lot of tangible bits to this, but there's also, I do think there has been, there's been a big cultural shift. You know, the aspirations of the sort of young players you're talking about, the last 10 to 20 years, young English footballers are coming through with an aspiration, expectation that they should be as technically good as the best of Spain, the best of Italy. I mean, Tony, you're about to talk about that, but how much has that changed since?
Well, that academy system was happening at Nancy, an unfashionable French club, in 1994 when I joined them.
And we're catching up, exactly.
Yeah, it was there.
But it wasn't at the clubs you'd been at previously in England in the same way?
No, not to that level. Not when I remember being surprised by seeing what was happening with kids from all over the world who'd been chosen via the academy, that they were being nurtured in their teaching. I remember a number of players. There was a boy called, you wouldn't know him, called Sofiane Connay. He was a French international, and he unfortunately had a terrible injury that finished his career. But he, and like many others, there was probably about 8 or 10 of them that were being, they'd done all their schooling at the academy in Nancy. And that was the same as Sochaux. That was the same as Auxerre. These are clubs that are not big clubs.
And so you went over there thinking, we're behind in England.
Oh, absolutely. I knew that, but I knew that when I saw the first five-a-side on the pitch at Marseille, when they had an 8-year-old five-a-side before every game, there would be five-a-side competitions, and I was like, how good are these kids? Mm-hmm. I was amazed. Honestly, I'm talking like it's in front of me now. I remember watching thinking, God, they're super talented. And that was before every Marseille game, and it happened on other French teams. There'd be games, and they'd be put on. So you take your eight. It wasn't you take them. They'd been chosen to play in these games, and the standard was super high. And so it never surprised me. But then, am I surprised when I saw European South American players better technically than the ones that come from these shores? No, I wasn't. Caught up. There's been a massive catch up.
Also, England should be at this level when you've got the best league in the world. There was a report just before the World Cup in Qatar, which kind of marked 10 years of the EPPP, and there'd been $2 billion of investment in academies. They'd basically doubled their contact time with the kids. There were so many advances that they'd made in a decade, but, you know, that should be the case. And they're now signing players like, you know, I referenced a player that Spurs have just signed who's 18, and they took him from under Barcelona's nose, bought him for $8 million, a Swedish midfielder. And look, there's also a bit of a case of the haves and the have-nots here, because some of the players you're looking at in that Liverpool group, you know, one was bought from Newcastle, one was bought from Sunderland. The big clubs have got the ability, and it's a no-brainer when you're spending. Alex Inglethorpe, the Liverpool academy director, made the point that if you've got three players on the bench every week for the first team who've come from the academy, with the average cost of a player, the average salary is like getting close to £70,000 a week now. Think of the money you're saving just by having three players on the bench, maybe another one in the first team. It's a no-brainer. Like, so I think the clubs are kind of waking up to that fact. And I also, like, I cannot tell you what Brighton's training ground is like. It's, they've got like a spa that looks like it could be in, you know, a luxury hotel. They've got rest pods, a yoga studio. They've got this vast gymnasium that is like this huge cavernous looking place. That's the academy one. Next door is another one that's even bigger, is the first team one. Rows and rows of pristine pitches, like a games room, canteen, and then there was what they were developing, renovating the first team rest, looks like a restaurant, looks like a like a Michelin star restaurant or something. It's incredible. So like everything, you just come away from it thinking, you know, they've got great coaching, they're getting really, you know, they're being really well educated, all these facilities. There are fewer cracks for talented players to fall down now in the system. Mm-hmm. I remember reading just the other day about Wayne Rooney. This was a story Rooney kind of gave himself voluntarily, that he was walking across the street once with a carrier bag with a big bottle of cider and some fags, and he saw stopping at a zebra crossing was his Everton Academy coach, and he was like, uh-oh. Like, yeah, Rooney turned out to be a brilliant player, and he came from a difficult background, as a lot of the players we're talking about do, but they're now kind of being welcomed in and they're having a kind of safety blanket thrown over them. There are less opportunities, you know, it's less likely for them to go down the wrong path.
I wanted to ask you, Gregor, because, I mean, the offices in London, Lizard offices, where all the data is being used as well, that's a place you probably could get to and visit. And
well, I'd love to, but I don't think they'd let you.
No, he's rather more reluctant about that.
I was going to say, you could probably try and get to there, but that mission impossible. So I ask us all here this question. So are we looking, because the transfer, and obviously is this a one-off, what happened in the January window with very low spending on made players, are we looking that investment's going to be all about potential further down the line, and maybe to a degree, I don't want to use it because it's only just happened in this window, is that big signings and Galactico stuff, is that going to be less of or not?
It'll depend on the rules. If the rules compel you to go down this avenue, then the answer, you know, there will be less of it. But if they scrap the profit and sustainability rules in their current form, and there's something else which allows more spending, the clubs are going to spend the money.
Exactly. I think there's always going to be both, but I just think there is, you know, if you're an owner and coming in, I mean, as we've seen some of the stuff that Ratcliffe is saying about Man United, there is just an expectation now of why are we not being smart? I mean, I know that's not every owner, and we've seen plenty that you know, just go on the ego trip or just reckless or, you know, seduced by the wrong agents or whatever. But I think at the highest level now, I mean, there really is no, with the resources you have, you know, sometimes that's been seen almost as, well, we don't need to be smart, but I don't think that is the case now.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, there is, we can afford, you know, not just the best coaches and players, but we can afford the best technical people as well, from all over the world. And what, you know, why the, yeah, as Gregor says, you know, why we've got these facilities, we've got the money, why are we not producing the best young kids as well? Any owner, we should ask that question.
Absolutely fascinating piece. I couldn't agree more. You can find it by looking for Gregor Robertson's name and the word academies either on the Times website, or if you search Google, you'll bring it up as well. Another one of your fascinating pieces, Gregor.
This is the Gregor show.
This is the Gregor Robertson show.
It's a slow week, isn't it?
All these fascinating pieces. But listeners, you might remember a discussion we had on a show a few weeks ago talking about stupid footballers. Well, are they stupid? And you, Gregor, you wrote a kind of response after we had that chat, which actually went down very well. We actually got quite a lot of support around the idea that footballers are not thick as mince, as the headline went. They're smarter than you think.
Yeah, it was kind of spurned by another piece I wrote about kind of footballers cutting holes in their socks, which I think we probably discussed as well. And the response was just remarkable, wasn't it? It was like, you know, as I said at the start, I started with, like, you know, thick as mince. You know, dim sheep. I've listed loads of
glove
of
puppets,
insults.
Fragile twits, posing intellectual rocking horses, overpaid prima donnas.
Yeah,
be a good intro for the next show, wouldn't it?
I was going to say.
So I just think, like, is there any other industry? Is there any other profession? Is there any other sport that is tarred with the same brush.
Definitely
entirely in a sweeping sort of generalisation like this.
Stupid footballers. Tony Cascarino? Sorry, what do you think of it?
The cheek.
Sorry.
Well, by what we've heard in the previous, in the last sort of discussion of all these academies now, that all these players being nurtured and helped with their education, there shouldn't be any, but there was quite a few in my time. And Gregor, look, come on, we've both been at clubs where we sometimes, you know, been tickled by some of the carry-ons of our
players.
Absolutely. Tony, what's your favourite?
Well, Jason McAteer was always my go-to, because Jason, he was a lovely man, and he still is a lovely man, but he would come out with classics, and someone said to me, how thick is Jason? I said, well, he said he could never understand why his sister's got two brothers and he's only got one. That's Jason in a nutshell. Do you know the BC and AD, you know.
Yeah.
Jason knew what BC was before Christ, okay? He thought AD was after dinosaurs. Seriously.
Tony, you're not really helping my course here, mate.
This is like, it reminds me.
That's an individual case. I'm not being unfair to Jason.
I mean, you're slightly unfair to Jason.
What was the line written about Dustin Johnson in golf? It's so dense that light bends around him. Someone wrote about it. Ones that
Right, yes. We shouldn't have done this.
But other than Jason McAteer, footballers are really clever.
No, but I have to say, I mean, it was a great piece Gregor wrote, and I think it was. Yes, I mean, Tony's throwing in the occasional exceptions, but I think it was a great piece just to correct a lot of what actually is, and snobbery. There's undoubtedly a lot of snobbery involved in that sort of looking down on footballers, Gregor, you know, and Gregor sort of, say, very articulate defence. And also just one thing I'd add is also the fact of, whether it's intelligent or not, what just about the stories these footballers have to say, because as you wrote, Gregor, they have got to the top of possibly the most, the most competitive sporting environment out there. Billions of people play football, you know, millions upon millions in this country. It's the national sport. If you get to the top, you've shown something extraordinary. But not only that, but the chances are that you've overcome some pretty big hurdles along the way. Mm. I mean, no footballer that I can think just sort of cruises, you know. They wake up, they're talented age 5, next thing you know, they're playing for England. I mean, it doesn't happen like that. You've got the mental challenges, physical challenges. You have knockbacks along the way. You know, there it takes a conviction, a character.
Resilience.
The pressure. I mean, you know, I get nervous, you know, hitting a golf ball in front of 6 people. The idea of running out and playing sport in front of 80,000 sort of blows my mind. So, you know, I think, and that's one of the things, back to where we started Gareth Southgate, but Gareth Southgate got these footballers to tell their stories, you know, tell their stories about, you know, this is what I've overcome, this is my background, these, you know, Raheem Sterling living in 10 different houses by the age of 12 or whatever, you know, maybe we're getting off the intelligence thing, but I just think that, yeah, there are human stories here, and the more they're heard,
that ties into what opportunities you're afforded at certain stages of your life.
So, but the more these stories are heard, the more maybe it'll break down this idea of whether it's, it's not about intelligence.
Nick Cox, the academy director at Man United, who I spoke to for that other piece, but he put a little bit in this piece about something he told me, is that he'd taken players on trips and they'd never seen the sea before. It just underlines like some of the circumstances that they come from. That doesn't make you thick, like I said in the piece. It makes you fight for everything that you get. So, it's what about what intelligence is as well. I defined it, and it's the ability to acquire and apply knowledge and skills. And like, if you're not doing that for the thousands and thousands of hours upon which you've tried to master the ball, honed the intuition, the spatial awareness, the speed of thought that you need, as Matt says, to become the very best in the world.
With the knowledge that millions of people will shout, "You're crap," the minute you do it badly.
You know, if you're not demonstrating some level of intelligence doing that. So, yeah, it comes back to snobbery, a bit of class prejudice about, about formal education. And as I said, and as we've just spoken about, that's also changing. You're getting more of an opportunity to acquire a decent formal education if you're in an elite academy. And as I also said, there are people who I turned 40 this year. There are people who I did my degree with, or who are my age, who are like teammates or former you know, our friends or contemporaries who are now like sporting directors in charge of multi-million pound transfer budgets, charity trustees, really smart coaches, they're doing new things, and it sort of broadens your horizons and your thinking, and you need to use your mind in a slightly different way. You're focused all your attention on one thing, football. Of course other things fall by the wayside a little bit, but it does not make you thick.
No, yeah. Definitely not. No.
Did you not mention one player in your article, Gregor, that, you know, done something daft? Just as a bit of lightheartedness, you know?
Everyone does something daft. That's what I
said.
Yeah,
I know.
We all do daft things. But there's always like, you know...
I know, but intelligent people do daft things.
I know, yeah. Look at our politicians. Yeah. That's what I said. I did say that in the piece.
Right, let's wrap it up.
It's not the preserve.
We're wrapping it up. I've got a lovely little thing to wrap it up, and we're moving on from politicians. It's a fascinating piece, Greg, and I recommend you check it out. And also, stick with us, Air Game Podcast listeners, for next week's special countdown special, Tony Cascarino against Jason McAteer. Now, moving on,
For next week, Tony's going to bring back his own favourite... your own favourite anecdote of when
Frank Sinclair didn't know an orbital you can go round both ways.
There you go.
No, seriously, M25, he said...
Tony, you should do another piece. You should do the riposte.
No, I'll get hammered because I've done some pretty daft things.
Gregor's talking nonsense, footballers are daft. Now, speaking of telling stories, again, this is coming back to listener feedback. Thank you to Josh Williams and Sam Jacobs who got in touch around our topic of fun and games of match report writing and late-changing storylines. Now, Matt Dickinson, a man of your experience... I wondered if you had any fun tales of last minute rewrites. Obviously, you were there in 99 for United.
It
was chaos, apparently, down the phone screaming at a copy taker.
Yeah, 99 is the one in legend, I guess. Excellent book about it if anyone wants to read it. That was obviously, I mean, it was the fact of it was the treble on the line, you know, the unprecedented at the time. The whole Man United story, the whole Ferguson story, you know, it was just everything. And then, obviously, when the first, the Sheringham goal goes in, because people have got to understand deadlines are so tyrannical in papers that effectively you've got to have the copy either sent or ready to send.
Match ratings.
89 minutes. Yeah, don't reveal all the secrets, but you've got to have it ready to go. And so the... we're sitting there and the piece is written. The piece is written and in some cases sent already, and suddenly Sheringham scores and it's mayhem, but then it's like, oh, we've got half an hour to sort of, you know, extra time to sort of, you know, get your head straight and start rejigging the piece for whatever might happen. And just as you're thinking, take a breath, we've got half an hour, bang, Solskjaer. And the biggest story, you know, in English football history at that point, as it feels like, is like...
You were saying the tech limitations.
Oh, and then the text down. I mean, this because, yeah, this is 1999, you know, no Wi-Fi that you can rely on, none of the stuff we take for granted now. And on a landline, trying to scream down a phone, it's called a copy, there was basically someone literally in the office typing out your copy. And it was so noisy, you couldn't hear if anyone could hear you. So it's literally, you know... screaming, you know, they've done the treble. Hopefully more, lucid and intelligently said than that. You're trying to capture history in 2 minutes on a phone that you don't know if anyone can hear you on the other end. So it was both the greatest sort of night of your professional life and for several hours afterwards felt like the worst because you weren't actually sure if you'd written anything that made any sense. What edition it would get into, you know, it was like, I'm so glad I was there, and yet I still feel scarred by the memory of what I wrote.
There you go, listeners. Yes. Proof, if ever it needed, that journalism is essentially just screaming into the abyss. Now, and you can check out Matt's excellent book on Manchester United and that 99 treble winning season. I'm sure you can find it in all good bookstores, Dicko.
Yes, you can. Yep. And some online retailers, but I won't mention
them. No, we won't mention those. Now, we're going to finish with a final question from Joel Lammy, who got in touch with this topic a good couple of months ago. So he might have ditched us as a listener for his podcast. So I'm going to have to email him and make sure he comes back because I wanted to make sure it was when Tony and Gregor were both on the show. He was talking about coaches like Pep Guardiola and Roberto De Zerbi moulding players and improving them. But he said he's often been frustrated with how so many managers complain about a lack of options and wondered if it would be not possible to coach them into new positions and therefore negate the need to go and spend fortunes on new signings. Is this something that we could see happening more often? And if so, do Tony and Gregor have suggestions for current players who could be coached into a different position? Also, one other question I would like to ask them both is why they think there are so few players who seem to be able to use their weaker foot properly. And will we see more fullbacks playing on the opposite flanks like Leonardo Spinazzola for Italy in the last Euros? Now, Mr. Left Foot, should we start with you, Gregor? How crack was your right foot when you were playing?
It was pretty, pretty
was
bad,
it?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Did you basically, were you full like Lionel Messi, never used it?
No, I could use it, but... If there was any way not to use it, I would take it.
Do we think that's something that's improved, though, to Joel's point? Something that why do we think that is? Is it just about coat? Is it that you just, you know, you've got, you're a left footer, so you're played on the left side, so you don't think about it?
I think, well, you know, most people, the fact is, most people do have a dominant side. It's like, as I said to you the other week, my little 2-year-old girl, I roll over the ball and she kicks it with her left foot, and I'm absolutely delighted. But it's also like she chooses to do that. Like, it's natural. So... I have to say, you know, when Tony was talking about seeing young kids in France like playing a little five, when I was at Crewe, I was amazed by the way they coached their players as well. Each player had their own ball; they were given their own ball, and like, they'd go home and they'd have like homework and things to do with practice with their ball, and then they had to bring it to training each time. And they were always doing little. Always the warm up was kicking the ball off the kind of panel of the wall with left and right foot, and doing everything with both feet. And the players I played with who got into the Crewe first team were all really good with both feet. Like, so it's coachable, and I think that probably is changing. Most players nowadays are you know, better than players in the past, I think, at that. But it's the truth remains, there is still a dominant side. So I don't think that'll ever change. I wrote a piece a while years back about why there's I think Port Vale Academy did this like novel sort of idea where they invited a trial day for left-footed players only, because they didn't have any in their academy. They had like they couldn't put left-sided players on the left in most of the youth teams. So some guy came up with an idea and it went viral, and they were getting like, you know, calls from Africa and America and stuff saying, "Can I come over?" I think I started the piece by saying my dad always like dined out on the same story, which is he rolled a little thing that was like a happy apple, a round little ball shape, a little cuddly toy thing, and he rolled it at me and I kicked it with my left foot, and he said, "You'll never starve." That's his story. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but
I've got a left foot, and it's definitely not, yeah, not like a shortcut. You had a left foot and talent, that's the big difference.
My talent, easy, let's not get carried away. Tony, in terms of that idea, left foot, right foot and header for you, of course. But before the show, you were saying that you genuinely did have a stronger side of your head when it came to heading the ball.
Yeah, well, I preferred crosses from the right side.
Right.
I was far stronger of attacking the ball from the right side than I was on the left side. I noticed it, and, you know, heading's a skill in itself. And, you know, I always used to say one of the great admirations I had for John Terry as a defender is that John didn't clear the ball and get distance. He gave it to his colleague. He was great at finding his partner or a midfielder because he could direct headers. I got rejected at 16 by QPR, and Theo Foley, who was George Graham's assistant, who many people will know here, was in the game. And Theo said to me, "You're very left-sided. You're an attacker. You need to be able to finish with both feet." And he said, "Come and watch Paul Goddard and Clive Allen finish." They were two 17-year-olds at the time at QPR. He said, "Well, I want you to watch them." I'm watching them and I'm thinking, "I'll never be as good as that. That's unbelievable. Them two finishing was scary." He said, "That's the standard. That's what you need to get to." He said, "I'll give you a piece of advice. You told me you head the ball against the wall a lot." He said, "And you're very good in the air." He said, "Do you use your feet?" And I said, "No." He said, "Use your feet. Force yourself to go right and left." I got better as I got older with my right foot, but again, like Gregor, not much better, but enough to make a difference to me. I never played football for 2 years. I've never really told this story. When I was 16, I stopped playing. I never kicked a ball in any shape or form for 2 years.
Because of the QPR rejection?
The rejection, and I decided that I ended up going to do hairdressing, you know, for 2 years, and I couldn't play Saturdays, and now and again I got the odd invite to play Sundays, but I basically really didn't play for 2 years, from 16 to 18. It was only when I quit hairdressing that I got invited to Crokinheel through a friend of a friend, as most of us do, and started playing again. But I did realise that my technical part of my game had to improve a hell of a lot to make it. And when I got abroad, I used to think everybody's good with their left and the right foot. There was, you know, and this idea of can players play other positions? There's loads. You could do. We could sit here and do a whole list of players who played, started in one position and ended up playing another. Mm. Gareth Bale, you know, for example, you know, end up being a winger when he was a fullback. You know, but there's loads of them sort of stories of players that could go centre half, right back, centre forward. You know,
and there's also the kind of this trend too to players who are almost like hybrid positionally as well. You know, as we know, fullback stepping into midfield, even centre half's doing the same. You know, and also kind of systems and shapes being much more fluid. Mm. So I think the more sort of all well-rounded, all-rounder footballer is going to become more and more valuable. Absolutely.
And if you can, I just add one really important point on this. If you're a really good athlete, which obviously some footballers are, they excel athleticism. They're brilliant. You can play anywhere on the pitch, in my opinion. You can, because if you're athletic, you can be a fullback at a heartbeat. If you can get up and down, you can be a fullback. If you can, you know, jump and you can just play way more many positions. I think the ones who couldn't play every position is certain things like if they can't get around the pitch, it would be tough for them now as being a fullback. It'd be tough for them to be a winger.
There's also an open-mindedness about this, isn't it? I mean, the open-mindedness of coaches to see that, you know, that, that there's imagination about this, creativity. I mean, again, back to the academies, there's been a lot of debate about whether you're trying to sort of cookie-cut certain players or actually. But I think the real gift of coaches is that they see the adaptability, the creativity in it. You know, you're not just trying to go like, okay,
pigeonhole.
You're not just stamped left back age 10. You know, why can you not grow into different roles?
Nick Cox said that about Kobe Mainoo. He was saying, you know, if there was ever any sort of bump in the road for him, it was actually about what position he was going to end up in, because sometimes they played him as one of the wide players.
Yeah, he started. Inside. Paul Hurst wrote his piece at the weekend about how he started as like a forward almost.
Like a wide forward, So, as we've said, you see him, he can carry the ball. Mm. He's like, but that's just another string to your bow. Midfielders are different to what they were 10, 15 years ago. They now have to be able to take the ball under real pressure at the back. That's almost like a prerequisite. And often they have to be like a driving force. They have to be able to run, carry the ball, surge through midfield.
Mentioning John Terry. I mean, just my understanding, John Terry played a lot of midfield as a youth. He looked like he had time on the ball when he played at the back because he'd actually played in the hurly-burly of midfield.
There's loads of examples of players who have played numerous positions.
Yeah, there you go, Joel. Thank you very much for asking that question. Not only did we get a big sprawling answer on football, we also found out about Tony Cascarino and his hairdressing career, which we will be returning to at the next international break.
We need a shampoo and set, Tom.
Sorry, this is just taking a mickey.
Yeah, I know. Matt Dickinson, this is not a topic for you. But listeners, please do get in touch, because as I say, that's proof that we do take great pride in all the questions and feedback that we get. So get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Matt Dickinson, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.